Accession number 28361, reel 25.
General Julian Thompson, reel 25. You were saying that, you know, it's virtually impossible to stop aircraft or helicopters being fired on always. That accidents are always a possibility.
Yes, because of human error. People will give the wrong grid reference, they'll mistake east for west, north for south. Mm. They'll get their own positions wrong, they'll get the position of the enemy wrong. And then they'll sometimes call down, get the target number wrong, so they call down a serial which is designed to hit the enemy target when they're on it themselves. So there'll always be, in my view, mistakes, and I think it's an error. It's one's deluding oneself if one thinks one will ever get round the problem.
You were saying that eventually you had two tents in the command post, and you described what was in one tent. What would go in the other tent?
Well, the other one was a replica. So you had a sack table. You had all the chairs. You didn't have to move the furniture. That was the point. The easel was there. All you had to take was the map.
Yes.
And put it on there.
Mm.
And while the headquarters was dormant, that map was being maintained as best they could with the information they had, which was always behind what we had, of course. Mm. And then you took that map away and put your own, the other map up, the one that you'd been maintaining in the live headquarters.
Yeah.
And then also you had in the radios and so forth, so they'd be switched on, but not used in the dormant headquarters. So you didn't have a situation where there was any pause in radio coverage.
Would the dormant headquarters be on listening watch?
Listening watch, yeah. Not transmitting, on listening watch, yeah. Mm.
And was all communication wireless, or did you have any line?
No line. Mm. No. Mm. It was all radio. Mm. I mean, the business of line, we might have used line more in wartime, but in peacetime, the whole time you had to pick it up. You couldn't just leave it lying around. Mm. So it was administratively an embuggerance, actually, using line. Mm.
You mentioning the Allied forces involved in these exercises around the Mediterranean on the southern flank, and that part of the purpose of them was semi-diplomatic or political deterrent. That would entail letting the enemy know what you were doing to some extent. Were you conscious of being shadowed and observed by Russian or other Warsaw Pact forces?
I never physically spotted them, but I knew perfectly well they were there. And of course, they were there at sea, particularly because they had these you know, spy trawlers that would follow you around, whether you were in the Med, the North Sea, it didn't matter where you were. There was always one of those E-Lint, I think they were called, trawlers were always around. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite sure that on these exercises ashore, wherever you were, there were people watching you, disguised as shepherds or tourists or whatever.
Mm.
We never caught any, as far as I know.
Mm. So they weren't intrusive.
No, you didn't have chaps wandering into the camp and that sort of thing. But they would be watching the landing. They'd be watching the exercise. They'd be watching the operation. They'd no doubt be monitoring the radio traffic.
Yeah. Did you have direct dealings with AF South headquarters in Naples?
We would only when we were running an exercise.
Yeah.
So we would have to go to AF South, and usually the first sort of conference about an exercise would be held in AF South. We used to also go there to have meetings about what I would call doctrinal matters, like, for example, the great document was ATP8, Allied Tactical Publication Number 8, which was amphibious operations, which was always being amended. Mm. And sometimes we'd have, you know, conferences where I'd have to go and represent the British point of view on what things we wanted to see in or out of that pamphlet. So we did go to Afsauk quite frequently, but often not dealing with them in the sense that we were dealing, you know, as a brigade headquarters. There were lots of headquarters above us, yes, who would deal with them. Mm. But the Afsauk headquarters was the venue for the first conference, for an exercise, a conference over ATP 8, and those sort of things. Very good restaurant they had there, I remember.
Italian chefs?
It was run by the Italians, yes.
Did you think ATP-8 served a useful purpose?
Yes, because it meant everyone was singing from the same hymn sheet. Mm. And it was quite a good document. It was very American. It was based on American amphibious doctrine.
Did that conform to British ideas of how amphibious...
More or less. Yeah, I mean, there were no great... I don't remember there being any great sort of points of issue, really.
How were the conferences... work there? Were they conducted in a formal and systematic manner, or were they informal?
They were generally, they used to split into sort of groups. So let's take an exercise conference. It would start off with, you know, this is the exercise, and the Third Commando Brigade are going to run it, and the enemy are, and the friendly forces are, and then it would split into subcommittees. You'd have a logistics subcommittee, you'd have a shipping subcommittee, you'd have an air support subcommittee, you'd have a land, you know, phase subcommittee, etc., and they would then get down to do the work in subcommittee to produce the outline of the exercise, who was taking part, who was going to turn up, when, what they were going to bring to it, etc., which would then produce a document from which, if I was planning the exercise, I would then base my exercise play on. I'd know that X, Y, and Z were coming, they were going to appear at such and such a time, they were going to bring this with them and that with them, the exercise was going to be held here, last from A to B, there'd be a wash-up in wherever. It was sort of laying out the whole scheme of how the, not the exercise, but the sort of background to it.
So you would have to extract what was relevant to you from
Yeah.
Were these exercise instructions very bulky?
Oh yeah, a lot of it didn't actually affect us directly because they were joint exercises. We had an opposite number headquarters in this country, which was the Commodore's headquarters in Britain, which was located in Portsmouth. Inconveniently, we were in Plymouth. It was in Portsmouth. Mm. And this was a sort of hangover, and I'll come back to this later. Eventually, it moved, but not for many years. And the Commodore was part of the staff of a chap called Flag Officer 3rd Flotilla. Mm. The Flag Officer 3rd Flotilla was responsible for commanding all the amphibious ships and all the carriers and all the LSLs. And he was based in Portsmouth. And he had a Commodore who became what they now call COMATAG, Commodore Amphibious Task Group, but was then called the Commodore Amphibious Warfare. And he had a staff, and his... In the amphibious phase, he and the brigadier sat side by side in the amphibious ship, the assault ship, and then the headquarters were sort of joint because the Commodore commanded the ships and told them where to go in response to where we wanted him to take them, to take us to where we wanted to go. Mm. So coming back to exercise planning, when we went to Naples, the Commodore staff always came too because the exercise not only involved us, the brigade, and all the other landing forces, but it would involve... the Sixth Fleet, U.S. Sixth Fleet, it involved carriers, landing craft, landing ships, destroyers, cruisers, all of which had to be brought into the game.
Earlier on, you said that you found naval officers rather old-fashioned. Was that still the case in the 70s when you were doing these exercises?
There were still some pretty autocratic naval officers around. Yeah. Yes, but they were less so. They'd become more. And certainly the people in the amphibious staffs were very flexible because they had to learn to work with other people. The problem one had was when you came across staffs who'd never worked in a joint atmosphere and tended to have a sort of naval tunnel vision.
Well, then they were just thinking about fleet action.
They were just thinking about fleet, you know, what everyone else did. They weren't interested in. They were just, I used to call it playing boats in the bath. That was all they were really interested in.
Now, naval gunfire has always been a very effective form of support for troops on shore. And the people directing that used to be called Forward Officers Bombardment.
Yeah.
Were they still?
They're now called Naval Gunfire Support, NGFOs, Naval Gunfire Forward Observers, NGFOs, have taken over the old FOB.
How did they work? Did they have...
Well, we had a commando regiment, Royal Artillery, which had three, in those days, pack howitzer batteries, 105, the Italian pack howitzer, one to support each commando, and then they had a fourth battery, which was the forward observation battery, which consisted of NGFOs and radio operators and naval telegraphists who were commando trained, because they could send Morse on HF sets if they had to. And then you then had a chap who was called the Naval Gunfire Liaison Officer, who was a lieutenant colonel, who usually sat on the ship that was coordinating the fire. And then the NGFOs used to talk on the radio to the ships as if they were talking to a battery ashore, and they were correcting and spotting them for the fall of shot.
So they'd be doing exactly the same job as the artillery for the observation.
But they were quite special in a way, because the NGFOs were semi-special forces, because quite often, and we did for real in the Falklands, they were landed before you got there. So they were on shore ready to start the program the minute you asked for it. So they had to get there in a covert way.
The secret OP is going on.
Yeah, there we are. And they were taught to land from submarines and things like that.
And what about forward air control?
Forward air controllers, we had a primary FAC in the brigade who was usually either Air Force or Fleet Air Arm. And then we had secondary FACs who were Royal Marines trained in FAC work. And you lobbed them out wherever required. So you had basically three FACs available, teams with vehicles, radios, and chaps. So you could allocate your FACs to the people who needed their support.
And so how far forward would they go? Would they go,
they go
down to
with a rifle company.
Yes.
So wherever they needed to be in order to spot for the air. I mean, they normally travel with battalion or commando headquarters. And then they would lob off to somewhere where they could actually spot. And quite often they'd be co-located with an FOO.
What sort of safety margin would you be thinking of allowing for close-air support?
I can't remember what it was. I mean, there was a peacetime margin and there was a wartime margin, which was as close as you wanted to take it.
And what about safety margin for naval gunfire?
Again, I think peacetime was something like 1,000 metres, but in wartime it was 100.
And artillery the same?
Same, yeah.
I think we dealt fairly thoroughly with the southern flank commitment.
Right.
That went on.
That went. I mean, I was involved with it all my time as brigade major. It then faded out of the picture in the mid 70s. It became less important. And I think one of the reasons was the rationale was that we couldn't support both.
Indeed.
And so that they faded out. And the northern flank, which was only just beginning to come in, really, when I was brigade major, though we did a couple of exercises up there, and became much more important later on when I was brigade commander, was, again, the object was to get there before the Soviets invaded. And, of course, they were much closer in North Norway. I mean, they had a contiguous border with the Norwegians. And one of the big invasion routes was through a place they call the Finnish Wedge. That was one of... there's a marvellous valley which leads right into North Norway through Finland. Would they... You know, the question, would they cross neutral Finland to come in? The answer is probably yes.
Would they cross neutral Sweden was another question.
Would they cross neutral Sweden to come in was another big question mark. And there, our principal purpose was to hold the airfields so that the Soviets would be denied them, and therefore their problem of attacking the U.S. and Royal Navy fleet, bringing reinforcements across the Atlantic, would be greater. I mean, the whole thing was round the thing called the rapid RRP was the initials, the rapid reinforcement plan, the NATO RRP, which depended for its efficiency on largely US formations coming across the Atlantic and some British formations come across the Channel to reinforce the Central Front. And there was envisaged there'd be a massive maritime battle across the North Atlantic in order to do so, prosecuted on the Soviet side by submarines, missile firing surface vessels, and their air force. So anything you could do to increase the range which they had to come and deny them the use of that North Norwegian seaboard and the airfields was deemed to be a good thing.
Now, another difference, of course, is that not only are the Russians much closer up in the north, they have a direct frontier with Norway, but the balance of forces is very much greater in their favour than it is on the southern flank. Because on the southern flank, as I remember it, the Warsaw Pact was actually outnumbered by NATO forces.
Yes, if everyone played,
if
they were.
If everyone joined in, yes. If NATO acted as an alliance, rather than fragmenting.
Yeah.
The Warsaw Pact would
we had a problem, and they had an access problem in that some of the people, some of the potential players had question marks against their names,
of
like
course.
The Bulgarians and the Yugoslavs. And
well, there's a great deal of uncertainty.
Absolutely.
Even if both alliances, Warsaw Pact and NATO, were confronting each other and all the allies in each organisation joined in, then the Warsaw Pact would be outnumbered in the air and on the ground.
Absolutely. And the Allies could use their sort of sea flank along the Mediterranean, the very powerful Sixth Fleet with its carrier battle groups. So they didn't actually have it all their own way. In the north, you're quite right. The only thing that went that was going for us in the north was the terrain, which channeled, however clever the Russians were, there was no way they could move their armour up those Norwegian mountains. They had to stick to the roads on the whole. They would have to use a lot of helicopters to move troops around.
Well, as I remember it, I mean, the Norwegian idea was you can't defend Finnmark, which is basically rather open and accessible, particularly from that Finnish wedge.
Mm-hmm.
You can defend Troms because you have deep gorges.
Sure.
But
and you fought a delaying battle back into Troms.
You've got one company on the frontier in Finnmark.
Yeah.
You've got the Brigade North based at Harstad, which is quite a long way.
Yeah, with one battalion
southwest.
Up at Bardufoss.
One battalion at Bardufoss, which is a rather minimal forward outpost.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have the threat of Soviet airborne operations into the rear, and also amphibious assault.
Exactly.
With the naval infantry coming down from
It was a pretty desperate situation.
Looking at the odds, even given the extreme geography, the odds, it does look desperate for the NATO side.
Yeah, it does. And so what was important was getting there early and getting to some of the key choke points before the opposition got to them.
Yes.
Using, as far as the commander brigade was concerned, using the sea flank for mobility, so you weren't tied to roads, and so you could use landing craft to get to places which you would otherwise have to drive to. And also, of course, the Norwegian mobilisation of their whole 6th Division was crucial. Were they going to be able to get their reserves and reinforcements up there in time? But it would have been a hell of a battle. Would the MAB, the Americans committed a Marine Amphibious Brigade to this area as well. Would they get there in time? So it was all a question of timing, really.
Well, a couple of related questions to that. Would the Finns fight? Would the Swedes fight?
Yeah.
Because that would make an enormous difference to the
rapidity
with which the Russians could build up their forces in the critical area.
Well, we reckon the Swedes and the Finns would fight, actually. Mm. And certainly the Finns, we reckon, would fight. Mm. And I think the Swedes would have fought too, actually.
Mm. The Swedish terrain is generally pretty inhospitable, isn't it?
Yes. And particularly very inhospitable, and all that bit, I'm just trying to remember the name of the place, the bit, we used to go there, near Birkvik, we used to send our gunners, I think it was Birkvik, to a very cold plateau on the Swedish border to do firing. And that, where the Swedes lost an army many years, you know, hundreds of years before, they were defeated by the Norwegians and they retreated. So some of those passes, the Swedish side of the border was far less hospitable than the Norwegian side, as you know. I mean, you know, there's some pretty big old mountains there, and particularly in the winter.
Which the boulder strewn slopes that are natural anti tank obstacles.
That's right. And it's not easy a country to move through. Yeah. I think, actually, I think the Swedes and the Finns would have fought rather than just give in to the Russians. I really do, actually.
Did you ever have any contact with the Swedes or Finns?
No. They weren't allowed to.
Well, people did things
about. And put it this way, I didn't at my level.
Yeah.
The only contact we ever had with Swedes was chaps used to go and ski in Sweden on their weekends off.
Now, you mentioned having to get there quickly. How long did you think it was going to take you to get to anywhere significant in the northern Norwegian coast? You know, when the alarm bell rings, you're told, right, it's Norway.
How long was a piece of string question in a way? I'm not knocking it, but it is, because it depended where the amphibious shipping was. What were they doing? And, of course, this is a real crippler, because halfway through my time as brigade commander, the Navy, in their inimitable fashion, with their lack of regard for amphibious operations, decided to turn the LPD, Fearless or Intrepid, into the Dartmouth training ship.
Yes.
So the Dartmouth training ship could be in the West Indies, you know, having fun with all the cadets when the bloody balloon went up. So really, the question is, how much warning were you given? Was it time to get it out of playing cocktail parties in the Bahamas and get it back to doing what it was meant to be doing, which is taking Marines into battle? So that was question two. Where were the LPHs? And again, the LPHs at this time are being run down. So were they going to be around? Mm. Or were they going to be playing anti-submarine exercises off the coast of America? So that was the key question. Not so much the Marines, who were, you know, as short notice as you wanted to do it.
But all right, let's assume then that it's best case. You know that the amphibious fleet you need is there. How long does it take you then to get up? Shall we say, Lofoten?
It would only take you. You know, from sort of. From a standing start, you could certainly be there within a week.
Yes.
That's loading time and everything.
Yeah. Was there ever any idea that the Marines might be flown into the relevant area?
No. Mm. No, because there was never going to be enough airlift available, because the airlift would be, in a time of tension, would be flying people like the AMFL out to their bit. Mm. The other game, the other players in Norway, of course, were the AMFL, which was a NATO organisation who had northern and southern flank commitments. Mm. So one of their commitments was northern flank. So that was, I can't remember who was in the AMFL, but it was the British AMFL battalion, which was an infantry battalion. And then there were, I can't remember who the others were, an Italian battalion, a German battalion.
I think there were about five.
There were about five, anyway.
Plus services.
Yeah, and they flew in. So all the airplanes would be flying the AMFL in.
Would that include impounded civil aircraft?
Probably. But certainly there was never, we never had an air move plan as part of our our contingencies. Mm.
Did you have any plans for deployments into southern Norway or Denmark?
Yes, we did. We did. And I can talk about those later when I was brigade commander, because I did quite a lot of actually walking the ground later. Because I decided anyway to do this seriously was to walk the ground. Mm. And so we had a reinforcement plan for southern Norway. We had a reinforcement plan for Schleswig-Holstein. Mm. And the Jutland Peninsula and the Danish Islands. There were reinforcement plans for all those, which we exercised later.
Later. So this beginning of the commitment of the brigade to North Norway, how did you ease yourself into that commitment? Was it a question of conferences with the Norwegians?
It was conferences with the Norwegians.
Visits to AF North?
Yeah, it was visits to AF North, and then talking to HQ 6th Division, and then liaising with Brigade North, and then doing as brigade major, I think we did, just trying to remember, not many exercises on the northern flank. I think I only did one major exercise on the northern flank in the whole of my 2 years.
Where was that? Do you remember?
That was, where was that now? It was fairly far north. I think it was in the sort of Lingenfjord area, yes. and south of that. It was in North Norway.
Mm. Did you ever get a chance to look at the Lingenlini defences in that area? I think they were a bit inland.
Yeah, well, I flew over them in my helicopter when I was brigade commander later, doing my recce.
Not on this occasion.
Not then, no. Mm. No.
So there was an exercise in the Lingenfjord. What was the form of exercise then?
Well, it was the good old... It was a repeat of what we did in the south. We had a sort of... This was larger because it was American-driven, this exercise.
Oh, yes.
And the Americans took part. Mm-hmm. And the Norwegians had a sort of love-hate relationship with the Americans. Who they wanted them there, but they regarded them as being amateurs when it came to fighting in the Norwegian Arctic, but we took it very seriously, our training. Mm-hmm. And I can come talk about that later, if you like.
Yeah.
But so they regarded us as being serious players. Mm-hmm. And so we went through this sort of deterrent phase. We did a deterrent landing and all that jazz that went with it, you know, the cross training. And then we withdrew and then we landed somewhere else. Mm. And then what we did, because Pat, my brigade commander, was very imaginative, was we used landing craft to outflank the enemy. And funnily enough, the Norwegians haven't thought of that, curiously enough. They for some reason, I don't know why, they were not alert to the sort of sea way of maneuver, because the Norwegian army is the Norwegian army and thinks of it as very sort of land-bound, I found. They weren't thinking of using the sea at all.
Well, there's no such thing as a Norwegian marine, is there?
No, so they didn't think of it. And and so we actually... I mean, one of the schemes that we came up with, which I think was very innovative, is we... rafted together two landing craft. We had four big landing craft. So they presented the radar target of a coaster. They were big enough. Mm-hmm. And then they moved round like coasters, and we landed a whole commando in behind the enemy and took them all by surprise. Mm-hmm. It was a night, of course. And so that was the sort of thing we were able to do and bring to the party, this idea of using the sea. And, of course, Pat Ovens had done a lot of raiding in Korea as a young officer. So, again, he brought that sort of expertise to this particular exercise.
What time of year was this going on?
This was... it was sort of late-ish autumn, so it was around October, I think. So it was wintry.
A bit cold at that time of year.
It was cold, it was wet, and there was a lot of darkness. We had a very nasty accident. The Americans drove a helicopter into the side of a mountain in the fog. A lot of fog, bad visibility.
It's ideal for clandestine movement.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it wasn't... There was snow on the higher ground, but on the low ground it was just wet. Miserable.
What did you think of the Norwegian level of training and...
Well, the Norwegian... I mean, I'd come across them before. I think I related doing exercises in Norway before, but their individual skills were quite good, but because of their very short conscription period, their collective training was pretty poor, quite frankly.
Is that still the case in 17?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
I mean, I think they lowered the length of service from the first time I came across them in the 60s. I think it was sort of a year. Well, I think it had been 18 months or something before. I think it was down to a year, I think, in the mid-70s.
And
the other thing, of course, about the Norwegian army, which you know, is that some people stay in their jobs for years. Well, they did then. I don't know if they do now. Because if a chap decided that he didn't actually really want to be in Brigade North because it meant he didn't see much of his wife and he spent a lot of time sort of hiking around the hills, then he spent forever in some headquarters down in Oslo, 10 years.
Well, that seems to be developing in other armies as well, making... Well, after the first few postings as junior officers, making postings more permanent, or extending the terms of them.
Yeah, sure. So you've got a lot of dead wood. in there.
Well, these people who are just going through the motions and are not thinking.
Absolutely. I mean, the sparky guys with battalion commanders and the chiefs of staff of brigade and brigade north commanders, always the sparky guys, the divisional commander of 6th Division, who I got to know very well later. Well, they were all sort of chaps. But some of them.